Thank you, Mr. Summers. Well, brethren, last time we spent the sermon discussing the top 10 intimacy needs in marriage. My hope at the time was that if you are already married, applying the suggestions would enhance your marriage and make it even better by either making you aware of or reminding you of ways to develop greater intimacy or closeness with your spouse. And of course, if you are not yet married, we hoped to help you prepare for marriage by being made aware of the factors of closeness or intimacy so that your marriage can start off on the right foot. And for those post-marriage, we hope this would also have been a learning experience for you to help in the case a marriage may be in your future, or, as we all know, the opportunity to teach others about some of the keys to happy marriage, which will be your responsibility in the world tomorrow. In the case that you were not here or did not listen, let me... Look, I shut it off after first one. I was so discouraged. But let me list those for you quickly so that it acts as an introduction into what we'll cover today. We talked about acceptance, how important that is in our marriages. A deliberate and ready reception with favorable, positive response. Our spouse feels accepted. They feel affection, number two. To communicate care and closeness, whether through emotions or physical touch. We talked about appreciation, the need to communicate with words and feelings, a personal gratefulness for the other. Then we talked about approval, expressed commendation, to think and speak well of, and how important it is for us to tell others about the wonderful things of our spouse. Then we talked about attention, to take thought of another, to convey appropriate interest and support, to enter into another's world. And we teased, as you remember, about sitting in front of the newspaper and not paying attention to our spouse, and of course how the newspaper has been replaced by the computer screen. I remember telling the story to the brethren in Youngstown that when our children were little, my wife had a very strict television policy. They were allowed 30 minutes of television a day, period, and that was after school, as a break from school before they started their homework. 30 minutes was it. But if you wanted their attention during those 30 minutes of whatever little show they were watching, you had to stand in front of them, between them and the television, and then after they tried to continue to look around you for a moment in the daze, then you could look at them. Sometimes we had to turn the TV off. Now, look at me. Look at my eyes. Are you listening? Paying attention now. Well, the same thing can be true in our marriages. Paying attention, taking thought, entering into another's world, putting the computer screen down for a moment. Then we talked about number six, comfort or empathy. Comfort means to come alongside with word, feeling, or touch and give consolation and tenderness. Then we talked about encouragement, to urge forward, to positively persuade. And yes, we can urge forward someone's behavior in negative ways by making them feel horrible, by guilting them, by shaming them. But that never, although it might accomplish an initial goal, never builds good feelings in our spouse, never builds intimacy or closeness. We're forced into doing what we know is right, and that's never good. Then number eight, we talked about respect and how valuable that is in a marriage, to value and regard another highly, to convey great worth. Then we, number nine, talked about security, the importance of confidence in harmonious relationships, that people feel safe, we feel free from harm, we know it will always be safe with our spouse. And last but not least, we talked about support, to come alongside and gently help carry a load. So, brethren, today let's take a look then, based upon those 10 aspects of intimacy. And again, there are others. There are some that you might add to that list that you feel are more important than those, and that's certainly fine. But let's take a look at how we might blend these intimacy needs into a lifestyle that will lead us to a closer, more intimate marriage. a closeness with our spouse. So our goal is to draw closer to our spouse in one of or all of three areas. Spiritual intimacy. We want to be spiritually close to our spouse, have a spiritual bond. We want to have an emotional intimacy. We want, in other words, have a real friendship with our spouse. We enjoy their company, enjoy their conversation. And then, of course, we enjoy a physical intimacy as well. So our goal in this sermon is to draw closer to our spouse in all of these areas. We desire closeness with our spouse. But how do we get there? Well, today we're going to talk about four simple ingredients, we might say. Now, they're easy to state, but they require thought and hard work to implement. But these four simple ingredients are important keys to developing true intimacy, lasting closeness at a deep level in our marriages. What might those four ingredients be? Now, like any recipe, for your particular marriage, one or maybe more of these might require a greater dosage, we might say, or a greater measure than some of the others. You'll have to be the judge of that. But if we mix these four ingredients together, I think we'll find that we've not just identified these 10 areas, but we've begun to learn how to put them into practice as well. The first one is this: affectionate caring. Affectionate caring. We're talking about, again, a way of life. Affectionate caring. Now, caring involves reassuring our spouse and showing fondness, concern, and attentiveness. Now, we ask, well, how do I show that I care about my spouse? Well, it's done in everyday actions. When we give our undivided attention to our spouse when he or she is talking, we are showing affectionate caring. Unless, of course, we accompany that undivided attention with heavy sighs and eye rolling. We may be paying attention, but it's obviously not affectionate caring. When we give priority time to be affectionate with each other, we make time for one another. Because to be honest, none of us have enough time. And we never have enough time for our spouse. When we pray for each other, certainly that is affectionate caring. When we do thoughtful, kind things for each other, we express affectionate caring. So I would hope that sometime between last Sabbath's sermon and today, you've had a chance to do something kind or thoughtful for your spouse. If not, we need to work on what we hear. Turn to Ephesians chapter 4 with me, if you would. Ephesians chapter 4. Because these things obviously are of no value unless we actually put them into practice. Unless we come up with a plan to do that. So affectionate caring can take several of our intimacy needs and begin to wrap them up into a lifestyle of this is something I can do. Affectionate caring, we might say, conveys this statement. I care about you. I care about you. Ephesians 4, in verse 31. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. We talk about a way of developing a right relationship with our spouse, as we said last time. Be a Christian to your spouse, not a heathen to your honey. That's Christianity in the home, right here. Don't let bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking infect our marriage. And then it says, well, what's the opposite? It's fine to say, well, don't do these things. But God is all about what should we do. Verse 32, and be kind to one another. Can you think of a better term that expresses affectionate caring than being kind to each other? I've been in situations, sadly, where people will relate later on that the only time my spouse is kind to me is when we're in front of others. when we go to church, when we go someplace else, then all of a sudden we get this kind treatment and this facade kind of gets painted on, and we supposed to look to everybody else like everything's just dandy and hunky-dory, but it's not at all. Be kind to one another. And then it uses a different word, tender-hearted. Tender-hearted. Are we, fellows, tender-hearted toward our wives? And wives, are you tender-hearted toward your husband? A soft heart toward our spouse. And then it's interesting that Paul tacks right on to that, after tender-hearted, forgiving one another. You see, when we're tender-hearted, our heart is open to another, and we are vulnerable. And therefore, we will have the need to be forgiving, because sometimes that open heart will be damaged. It will be hurt. It'll be abused, possibly, in the sense that not taken care of properly. It won't be looked at in the way that it should. Tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. The word tender-hearted here in the Greek means well-compassioned. Well-compassioned. In other words, tender-heartedness means showing great compassion for our spouse. In other words, sympathetic. Tender-hearted. When we express affectionate caring to our spouse, we are well-compassioned or sympathetic toward them. The focus is not on us. The focus is on our spouse. Turn with me, if you would, over to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. Here in 1 Peter, we have the same word, tender-hearted, being used. And again, while it talks about us in the church and how we treat one another, we want to first and foremost apply these things to our spouse. Do we have tenderness when it comes to our spouse? Is it a business relationship? You know, you don't think of business relationships as tender-hearted. We've got some guys coming over on Monday to dig up our foundation. And they're very nice people. And I hope I'm very nice to them. But tender-hearted? No, it's a kind of a business relationship. Glad they're coming over. Wonderful. But no, tender-hearted is a family relationship. Certainly should be a marriage relationship, a church relationship. 1 Peter 3 and verse 8. Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. So would our spouse describe us in our affectionate caring of them as compassionate? He is so compassionate toward me. He really understands or tries to understand what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what I'm going through. She really has compassion for me. When I tell her that that shoulder is really killing me again, she starts to rub it. She offers me analgesics or whatever it might be. There's a real compassion there. There's a tenderness there. So he says, have compassion for one another. Love as brothers. Be tender-hearted. Be tender-hearted. Be well-compassioned. Be sympathetic. Be sympathetic. Then it says, be courteous. Wow, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing if that describes our marriages? That the affectionate caring that we have for one another is tender-hearted. It is sympathetic. It is well-compassion. It's tender-hearted. Verse 9 reminds us, not returning evil for evil. So yes, sometimes your husband will do evil things. Not because he's intending to, hopefully, but he just will. And yes, our wives sometimes will do evil things because we're still human. But we don't return evil for evil. And sometimes it's not really evil, but it's perceived as being evil by us. So we don't return evil for evil, or reviling for reviling, name-calling. But on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. For he who would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. When we think of being tender-hearted, when we think of affectionate caring, surely what is far away from us is an evil tongue and lips that speak deceit, trying to deceive or intending to deceive, deliberately misleading, certainly is not a part of our marriages. Verse 11, let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it, again, in our marriages. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. We're being judged by him, and his ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. So affectionate caring is one of those ingredients. It begins to take these 10 items that we talked about last time and spins them into a way of life. That affectionate caring. And surely sometimes security issues will express our care and concern. What blocks affectionate caring? Affectionate caring can be hindered by anger, bitterness, and resentment. It's hard to have what we call affectionate caring when we're angry, when we're harboring bitterness and resentment for past behaviors, for past problems. That has to go. Showing fondness and interest and concern and attentiveness conveys closeness, affectionate caring. As a test, or as something that you could take home to use, fill in this statement. I feel cared about when my spouse, and then fill in the blank. I feel cared about when my spouse, and you fill in the blank. I feel cared about when my spouse does, says, thinks, carries out, whatever it might be. And then when you have an opportunity, sometimes share that with your spouse. I really feel cared about when you fill in the blank. Then we'll have a specific thing that we can carry out, that we can do, that we know helps our spouse to feel cared about. Because have you ever been in a situation that I just don't know what to do? I know I should be doing something, but I'm not quite sure. I think she would like, or I think he would like, but I don't really know. Well, this would actually give you, as a spouse, a specific thing to be able to accomplish. So we want to show that kind of fondness and closeness. Turn over a page to 1 Peter chapter 5. Affectionate caring means being tender-hearted toward our spouse, showing fondness, showing concern, showing attentiveness. Think of the words affectionate caring. 1 Peter 5, in verses 6 and 7. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. And we'll focus on verse 7. We're to be humbling ourselves before God. Verse 7, what else? Casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. He cares for you. Isn't it true that we know, as we heard in the sermon, that God cares for us? He really does love us. Would our spouse be able to say the same? Can she cast all her cares upon us because she knows we care for her? Can our husband cast all his cares upon you because he knows that you care for him? Good questions to ask. So affectionate caring is the first ingredient that we want to see mixing these 10 components together into a lifestyle. The second is this. If we want a really close marriage, it requires, number two, the second ingredient, vulnerable communication. Vulnerable communication. Well, what does that mean? Vulnerable communication is an openness. An openness. A relationship that risks being open about feelings and needs and hurts. In other words, an open book. An open book. Sometimes when women are hurt, they become quite verbal. Now, that's not an insult, but that's how it's dealt with. Men, on the other hand, oftentimes when they are hurt, the exact opposite takes place. The faucet is turned off, and silence ensues. Backing off ensues. Running off to our man cave ensues, whether it's the garage or whether it's work or whatever else it might be. What we're looking for in this lifestyle of happy marriage is open communication, vulnerable communication. It conveys trust. And one of the basic ingredients of a happy marriage is trust. I trust you. I trust that I can say this and I will not be put down. I'll not be made fun of. I'll not be castigated. Vulnerable communication. Now, obviously, when we're open in our communication, it takes a lot of love. It takes discussing things in an open and honest manner, but in a kind manner. That's why tender, affectionate caring comes first, and then open communication. So this ingredient says, I trust you enough to lay out my innermost thoughts and my hopes and my fears. And we do this when we share our hopes of the future. We do this when we share our feelings of worry or concern, when we have fears. We do this when we express what is most pleasing to you. Have you ever wondered what would really make my spouse happy? What is it? Well, when we're able to express that, if we express it and our husband says, "What? You got to be kidding me! That's nuts!" Ooh, not too vulnerable there, not too open. Turn to Ephesians chapter 4. If we ask our husband what is most pleasing to him, how can we please him? And then we ridicule his answer and say, well, that's ridiculous. Then that's not going to foster a closeness in marriage. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 29. Ephesians 4 and verse 29, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth. Interesting that other translations render that, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. What is a corrupt word? Well, a corrupt word obviously could be foul language, no doubt about that. Oh, I think that that's a little too limiting. He's not talking about just dirty words or something like that. Of course, you remember the story about the young couple that just got married. And a week after the honeymoon was over, the daughter calls mother and said, Mother, I've got to come home. You've got to rescue me. I've got to come home. You won't believe what's going on here. And she says, well, dear, what's the problem? Well, ever since we've been back for the honeymoon, my husband's been using these horrible four-letter words all the time. She said, really? It didn't seem like he was that kind of person. Yes, he's horrible four-letter words. You've got to come rescue me. And she said, well, what words is he using? Oh, Mother, he's saying things like wash and iron and cook. These horrible four-letter words. Okay, nobody irons anymore, hardly. But nonetheless, you understand the point. Let no corrupt word, it's not just talking about dirty words, but it's the way we speak, the phraseology we use, the attitude with which we speak can be corrupt. So you have to analyze your communication with your spouse. Is it more often corrupt? In other words, if people were to be able to listen in to those conversations, to those statements, would they see love and honor expressed? Would they see openness and trust expressed? Or would they see anger, casting of blame, pointing of the finger, and such things as that? That can be corrupt communication or corrupt words. Let no corrupt word, verse 29 says, proceed out of your mouth. But what is good for necessary edification? What is good? What is edification? We talked about that last time. It's building. Only what comes out is what is good for building each other. Now, that's not to say that that doesn't include correction, because it does. Sometimes our spouse needs to hear from us what they are doing. that can be destructive or harmful or hurtful. But that's for what purpose? It's not to attack them or hurt them. It is to build the marriage, to build the situation. So what is good for necessary edification? Why? That it may impart grace to the hearers. So when we apply that in our marriage, openness of communication, we're willing to tell our spouse how we feel. We're willing to share with them in an open manner things that we do not share with anyone else. Turn over a few pages to Colossians. We skip over Philippians and go to Colossians chapter 3. Colossians 3 and verse 8. Would you characterize your communication with your spouse as totally open? Or do we constantly find ourselves saying, well, I could never say that to my spouse. You know what kind of thing would go on? You know the fire I would start if I said, hey, could you do this or could you do that? Or why haven't you done this or why haven't you done that? You know the kind of fire that would start? You know what kind of treatment I would receive if I brought that up? Well, vulnerable communication may be something that can help in our marriage. Openness takes a lot of trust. It conveys, I trust you. Colossians 3 and verse 8. But now, you yourselves are to put off all these. Now, I don't know for sure, but it strikes me when Paul writes this, that there may have been a tendency among some in Colossae to hear what Paul wrote and say, well, I sure am glad he's saying that, because so-and-so down the row really needs it. So what does Paul say here? You, yourselves. This is all of us. This is a Christian thing. It's everybody. But now you yourselves, everybody, don't apply this to somebody else. Apply this to ourselves. Now you yourselves are to put off all these. So again, in our communication, do these things come out? Anger, wrath, malice. Now, does that mean we won't be angry from time to time? Well, of course not. Of course we're going to be angry from time to time. Sometimes our spouse will do things that make us angry because they're not perfect yet, and neither are we. So we're putting those things off. We deal with that in a different way than the world does. Anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. So in Ephesians, we have these corrupt communications. In Colossians, filthy language is a part of that. So we rid ourselves of that. We strive to overcome. Verse 9, do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. So our communication should not contain unbridled anger. We should not worry that we are saying something that we will deeply regret saying in the future. Saying it in such a way as to be offensive. And again, we have to deal with the anger that comes up with things that are not yet perfect, but we shouldn't be stating it in such a way that it causes terrible hurts. We address the issue, not the person. So oftentimes when anger issues come up in marriage, we address the person instead of the issue. And the person becomes the problem instead of the issue. You see, vulnerable communication conveys that I trust you. I trust the best in you. I know you are intending what is best for me. Even if you've said it like a complete yahoo, I know what you mean. I know that your heart really is for my benefit. And that can be a very important distinction. And then we address the issue instead of the person. What are some blocks to open or vulnerable communication? The biggest block usually is fear. Fear. We're afraid to say what is really on our heart and on our mind. And sometimes we don't know quite how to say it. So that's the time, of course, to zip the lip, pray about it, and bring it up at a time that we have control over that. We have a way to phrase this that can be useful and beneficial. Rarely is it useful to address an anger issue in the heat of the moment. rarely is that productive, because oftentimes we don't have the self-control to put it in such a way that it can be heard. Now, it's very important not to ridicule our spouse, especially when they're being vulnerable and kind of giving us a glimpse inside their heart and mind. Very important not to ridicule, not to make fun of or belittle their thoughts or feelings. Turn with me finally in this category to 1 John 4, verse 8. 1 John 4 and verse 8. This is what we want our marriage to be characterized by, this open, loving communication. In verse 8, he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. Don't you sense that you can be completely and totally open with God without any fear? Then down in verse 18, there is no fear in love. No fear in love. So we want to be able to communicate as openly as we can without the fear of being drug across the coals. Isn't it true, at least I hope it is, that you can say things to your spouse that you would never say to anybody else, except maybe to God directly, because we know they understand. We know that they'll take it in the right context. And we know that if we say something stupid, they'll be kind and forgiving toward us. At least we should know that. There's no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. There's this openness with our spouse that we have with to the same level with no one else other than God. Goes on to say, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. So we would love for our marriages to come to the point of such perfection that there's no fear whatsoever. We know that we're in a safe place. So we can be open and communicate our thoughts and our feelings and our goals and our future and our past and be completely safe in that. Let's go on to a third of the four ingredients that we'll cover today. The third of four ingredients is this: joint accomplishment. Joint accomplishment. What do we mean by joint accomplishment? Well, this area of closeness in our marriage comes from enjoying specific activities together. It might include developing common interests or setting and completing family or household goals. It might be doing specific tasks together. We develop this joint, this teamwork, this we're working together. If you would, turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Joint accomplishment, in essence, conveys a couple things. I like being around you, and probably more importantly, I need you. I need you. I need you to help with this. We need to work together. I can't do this by myself. Undoubtedly, there are things that we do alone. Things that our spouse may not be particularly interested in doing. I've mentioned to you before, I think, there are times during the long winters that my wife loves to scrapbook. She loves making cards and putting them together and sending them to people. She does a great, unbelievable job with that. If I had to sit and scrapbook, it would be like pulling my teeth out one at a time with the pliers. And a hammer. No, I'm kidding. It's not that bad. But it's just not an interest of mine. I'm not very creative that way. I can't envision those things. And she does an amazing job. So that's something we do separately. And I suppose if she had to sit in a deer blind with me, it would be like pulling her teeth out one at a time with a hammer. So it's not something she enjoys. But there are many things we enjoy doing together. And certainly that's the key. There has to be certain together activities and interests, common goals, whether it's work you do together, work on the house, work on the yard, work on the kids, work on the grandkids, work around joint accomplishment. It conveys, I need you. We're a team. We're in this together. And you experience the intimacy of needing your spouse when you, for example, enjoy the excitement and joy of having a baby? I mean, do you have a more personal working together for joint accomplishment? You work together to paint a room, to fix up the house, to beautify some aspect of your life or your home. Those are wonderful things. Here in Ephesians 5 and verse 30, "For we are members of His body." So again, as you're thinking about this, what things are we doing together or could we do together in a joint fashion that will draw us closer together? I mean, you see this kind of thing kind of idealized on the television. You know, a young couple gets married and they get that apartment and they decide what color paint we want and they slap paint on each other and everything's wonderful and it's great. And okay, just joint accomplishment. Again, they're trying to picture that this is brings us closer together. We're working together for a common goal. There's a togetherness there. We're members of His body, of His flesh and of His bones, verse 31. "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife." Joined together. Joint accomplishment. We are in this together. We are a team. "And the two shall become one flesh." Now again, in the Old Testament, where it says, "Man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife," there's a togetherness there that we're working on this together. And again, we're not going to do everything together. We might not do a lot of things together. But there need to be some joint accomplishment. We're working together. "The two shall become one flesh." Verse 32, "This is a great mystery," he says, "but I speak concerning Christ and the church." That's what we're picturing in our marriages. Joint accomplishment. God expects us to do our part. We're in this together. He leads, we respond. Verse 33. "Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself. And the wife, let the wife see that she respects her husband." So you could ask yourself this question. Together with my spouse, I would enjoy... dot, dot, dot. I guess it's not a question, it's a statement. Together with my spouse, I would enjoy, and then you fill in the blank, redecorating a room, painting the bedroom, shopping for, okay, ladies, don't do that to your husband, please. No, I'm kidding. If you would enjoy that, get him out there and have him look at some of those comforters and find out what would look nice, and he'll say, "Hey, that looks great." The first one he sees, because he probably doesn't care beyond that. But the point is, we're together in this. "Together with my spouse, I would enjoy." And again, when you have an opportunity, maybe sometime exchange that with your spouse. And again, you've got something specific that you can be doing that builds the togetherness within our marriages. Now, obviously, when we put that down on the paper, we think about the other person, not just ourself. So as I said, I wouldn't put down that together with my spouse, I would enjoy turkey hunting because I know she'd be miserable. Or I would enjoy scrapbooking because she knows I would be less than happy. So we think about what could be done that can be mutually enjoyable. And there are things that can be done. Maybe something you're already doing, or it may be something completely different. So you'll have that opportunity. Turn over to 1 Peter, just a page or two back. 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3, in verse 7. We've read this verse in different circumstances, but we'll look at it in this concept of joint accomplishments. "Together with my spouse, I would enjoy..." dot, dot, dot. Sometimes it's just going for a walk. It might be sitting in the park. It might be feeding the ducks. It might be whatever it is. It's time together. There's joint... we're in this together. We're a team. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. "Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding." It takes understanding to dwell with our wives. "Giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel." Now, you would think that that would have been obvious. And frankly, it is more obvious in our culture today than it was in Paul's day or Peter's day. When Peter wrote this, in most cultures, women were property. And so when Peter wrote, no, you need to have some understanding about this. You need to treat your wife with honor. Well, that was unheard of. That was new information. Give honor to your wife. Now, I would say in our culture, the exact opposite probably has taken place. And our women need to be reminded to give honor to their husbands because they are disrespected in every phase of our culture. So it's an important thing for a wife likewise to give honor to her husband. But in this case, Peter is saying, be sure to remember to give honor to your wife as if or as to in the same way that you would a weaker vessel. In other words, more precious, more fragile in that sense. I think I told you a little bit about my friend Fred, the car repairman. I always tell Fred when I bring the car in, Fred, if you take care of your car, take care of your wife, you'll go all kinds of places in life. You don't take care of your wife, you don't take care of your car, you get up on the side of the road, broke and stupid. And he always laughs about that, but nonetheless, it's true. So I always wash the car and vacuum it before I take it in for service. Why? Because they treat it better. It's clean, it's neat. Boy, this guy takes care of this car. Now, I'm not going to say it's the only time I ever washed and vacuumed the car, but why? They treat it better. Take care of your wife. Take care of your car. You go places in life. Same thing here. Now, obviously, we're not talking about the spiritual things. Obviously, our relationship with God is more important than those two, but you understand the point. Then he says this, as being heirs together of the grace of life. There's something about treating your wife with honor. There's something about treating your husband with honor that helps you and me spiritually. Because it is a spiritual issue after all. When we show honor to our spouse, it is a spiritual endeavor. And it helps with our relationship with God. Well, why? Well, because our relationship with God is on a spiritual plane. Our relationship with our spouse is, yes, on a spiritual plane, but it's physically carried out on the physical level. So when we do this on the physical level, it helps us spiritually. And we are heirs together. Now again, for Peter's culture, that would have been a pretty surprising statement. I mean, joint heirs, that's the way this same word is translated elsewhere. Talks about we're joint heirs with Christ in Romans. Same word. We're heirs together. We're joint heirs with our spouse. That would have been revolutionary understanding at that time, that they both are spiritual equals before God. So when we treat our spouse with respect or with honor, it's a tremendously helpful thing for our intimacy, for our closeness. We are honored by each other. And then we're heirs together of the grace of life that your prayers may not be hindered. We won't go into more detail there. So there's a partnering concept of joint accomplishment, of sharing life together that is critical for an intimate marriage. Now, what's one of the major blocks to joint accomplishment? It's an attitude of self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency. I don't need you. I can do just fine by myself. It's not wise for husbands or wives to generate the concept of I don't need you around. I am completely self-sufficient without you. Others helping brings intimacy, brings closeness. If we're not allowed to help you, then there's no closeness there. I don't feel like I'm a part of the team. I don't feel like I'm really helping much. Turn to Galatians 6 and verse 2, then we'll move on to number 4. Galatians 6 and verse 2. We've read this once before, but we'll read it in this context. Galatians 6 and verse 2. There we go. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. There is something about helping another that draws us closer. Now, there are those who will teach, for example, if you want to get something done in business, ask someone else to help you. Ask for help. And when you do, in fact, there was a very good book that I recommend to our 20-somethings, recent high school graduates. It's called The Deciding Decade, What to Do with Your 20s, or Why Your 20s Are Important and What to Do with Them. And one of the things this psychologist recommends for a young person is ask someone to help you. And when you ask to help, most people, first of all, are willing to help. They want to share their experience with you. And when they do, they feel better about themselves as well, that I've helped someone. And there's an automatic closeness that is built because we're helping. There's a closeness there. Well, how much more in our marriages? How much more when we bear one another's burdens and we care for each other? We're in this together. My wife is absolutely slammed with the kids right now. So if I do something that normally she would have to do, does that bring us closer together? Well, of course it does. How thoughtful, how kind that he understands we're in this together, and he's stepped in and done this. When a husband is absolutely at his wit's end and he's slammed and he's running to his responsibilities at 90 miles an hour, and a wife steps in to do something that he would normally do, to help bear the load, does that bring one closer? Oh, absolutely. How kind, how thoughtful that they would recognize what's going on here and step in to help. It's a wonderful thing. We need each other. And joint accomplishment helps that understanding, and that need draws us closer together. Last but not least, number four, the fourth element, the fourth ingredient in mixing together these 10 elements of intimacy, and that is mutual giving. Mutual giving. Mutual giving refers, in essence, to two people who think more highly of each other than of themselves. Focus is on giving to each other rather than taking. A very wise teacher once taught us that there are two basic ways of life. There's the way of give and the way of get. The way of give might be called the way of love. Mutual giving conveys, I love you. I love you. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5, a page over from where we are. Ephesians 5, a couple pages from Galatians. Ephesians 5, in verses 1 and 2. You experience the intimacy of love when you surprise your spouse with breakfast in bed. Mutual giving. Unless they hate breakfast, then maybe lunch in bed or a cup of coffee on the deck or whatever it might be. You experience the intimacy of love when you ask what they need that day. What can I do for you? How can I help you? You experience that intimacy when you notice what needs to be done and just do it. When you make a 30-second phone call or send a text that says, I love you and I'm looking forward to being home. Experiences of love that reflect mutual giving. And we ask ourselves, how many times do I text others and never text my spouse? Something to think about. Again, small things that build closeness and intimacy along the way. Ephesians 5 in verses 1 and 2. Therefore, be imitators of God as dear children. In other words, in the same way that a small child imitates a parent, Paul is saying we need to be imitating God just like those little children imitate us. Verse 2, and walk in love. Walk in love. Mutual giving is love. Walk in love as Christ has also loved us and, surprise, given himself for us. God expressed his love toward us by giving. Christ expresses his love toward us by giving himself, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. Christ gave himself. We give ourselves. How can a person not develop greater love and intimacy toward us when we are constantly giving, serving in that sense? What's one of the great blocks to mutual giving? Giving is often hindered by simple selfishness. Simple selfishness, in other words, focusing on our own needs rather than our spouse's. When we focus on our spouse's needs, ours will be taken care of. Luke chapter 6 in verse 38. Luke chapter 6 in verse 38. Again, we read this verse in many other contexts, but let's look at it in regard to this aspect of mutual giving in marriage. Luke 6 in verse 38 applies first and foremost in our families, and then outward toward others. We're reminded by Christ to give. Give, and it will be given to you. Now, isn't that an interesting thing? He doesn't say, give and suck it up. You know, it's just the way it is. You're going to have to suffer. No, he says, give. Now, will there be suffering? Sometimes, of course. Sometimes we'll be giving and we'll feel like we're doing all the giving. We're not receiving much in return. Well, what are we supposed to do? Keep giving. Give, and his reassurance is, it will be given to you. The needs that we have will be supplied, either by our spouse or by God himself. Or we'll come to see that, well, what we really desired or what we had a need for wasn't that big a deal after all. And it takes his place. Give, and it will be given to you. It's a promise. Not just given to you, but good measure. You cannot outgive God. And I would say it's a goal of ours to strive to outgive our spouse. And if that's our attitude, we'll find we can't. We can't, because they'll be striving to outgive us along the way. Give and it will be given to you, not just a little bit, but good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. So we can set up a giving contest. I'm not saying that we have to have a judge, but can we set up a giving contest in our minds with our spouse and see if we can win the challenge of, I'm going to outgive my spouse. I'm going to do more kind things than she is. Or I'm going to do more loving things than he is. I'm going to do more service things to them or for them than they are for me. And see if we can win. Talk about a positive contest. Unless we say, I've done more giving than you have. Then we're kind of defeating the purpose. Turn to Deuteronomy 15. Deuteronomy 15, we don't normally read this section of Scripture, period. But let's read it in this regard, because it talks about this heart of giving. One of the great, great things about the Scripture is this concept of how important it is to be a giver, and how this has shaped Western culture over the millennia. This concept of, it's our responsibility to care for others. And again, let's apply this specifically in our marriages. Deuteronomy 15 and verse 7. If there is among you a poor man of your brethren, within any of the gates of your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. Now, if we're to take care of the poor, in this case, in the church, we would say, in our Israel, if we're not to shut our heart to them, how much more should our heart be open to mutual giving to our spouse? Verse 8, you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Now, it doesn't just say give it away, lend it to him, work with him, help him back up on his feet. But again, apply this in our marital situations. Are we giving to our spouse in the same way we're told to give to the poor? He says, beware, verse 9, lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing. And he cry out to the Eternal against you, and it become sin to you. In other words, I got to keep this for myself for the future. I can't help you. Giving without holding back. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him. Because for this thing your God will bless you in all your works and in all to which you put your hand. Wouldn't that be even more true in our marriages? As we give to our spouse, will not God provide what we need? Verse 11, the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother and to your poor and your needy in your land. Now you pause for a second. One of the reasons there will always be poor among us is so that we always have an opportunity to give. Now we can say, if they would just, ... and fill in the blank, they would just get an education, they wouldn't be poor. You know what? That may be true. If they would just use their resources more wisely, they wouldn't be poor. That may be true. But they'll always be there, always offering us an opportunity to learn how to give. So if we're going to be giving to the poor of the land, our Israel, how much more do we want to be mutually giving to the one closest to us, our own spouse, our own husband, our own wife? Let's look at two other scriptures and we'll close. First, Mark chapter 4 and verse 24. Mark chapter 4 and verse 24 is Mark's rendering, maybe of the same event we read about in Luke, or it may be another occurrence that Christ said something very similar. You know, sometimes when people write about the Gospels, they say, well, Luke said it this way, and Mark said it this way, and Matthew said it this way. You really wonder who got it right. And we would always say, all of them. Do you think in 3.5 years of ministry, Christ never repeated a concept somewhere and said it maybe a little bit differently? Now, I've been here long enough that many of you could probably write down phrases that I've used regularly. I can't think of any right now, but you probably could. Well, you always are saying this. Would we say it differently in one occasion than another, but very similarly? Well, of course, that happens in the Gospels all the time. That it's the same concept, but do you think he only said it once in 3.5 years? Of course not. He's repeating these things over and over again. John says if we wrote down everything he said, we couldn't contain him in all the books of the world. There'd be so many things to try to do a word-for-word transcription of Christ's life. So Mark may have been writing of a different occurrence, may have been writing the same thing, but from his perspective. Mark chapter 4 and verse 24. He said to them, take heed what you hear. Take heed what you hear. What does that mean? New International Version says it this way. Consider carefully what you hear. Listen carefully to this statement. That's what he's saying. With the same measure you use, it will be measured to you. Boy, does that mean we want to err on the side of giving? Well, it certainly should. Take heed. Carefully consider this. With the same measure you use, it will be measured to you. And you who hear, more will be given. Let me read the whole thing from the New International. Consider carefully what you hear, he continued. With the measure you use, it will be measured to you and even more. Boy, do we want to err on the side of generosity with our spouse? Mutual giving? When both are giving, striving to provide what the other needs and wants and desires, how can the marriage not be tremendously happy? When God's Spirit is involved and we're both striving to give, how can the marriage not be happy? 2 Corinthians chapter 9. We'll close here. 2 Corinthians 9. We read this scripture from time to time in regard to offerings, in regard to giving in general. But again, let's apply this in our marriages. When we are mutually giving to one another in marriage, There is a closeness that comes. There's an intimacy, a tenderness, a connection that all marriages desire. 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 6, but I say this, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. He who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. It's a guarantee. You give to your spouse, and your spouse, if they have God's Spirit, will be inspired to give to you. It's an automatic. When God's Spirit's involved, it's an automatic. So, verse 7, let each one give as he purposes in his heart. Now we know this is talking about the offering that Paul was inspiring them to collect for the needy saints down in Judea. But again, apply this to our spouse. Let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. If we give to our spouse grudgingly, do you think they'll catch on? Okay, I'm going to empty the dishwasher, but I'm banging the dishes around because the woman didn't get up early enough to do it herself. You think it's obvious? We're banging things around. Did we accomplish what we were hoping? Obviously not. So give, not grudgingly, not of necessity. God loves a cheerful giver. An opportunity to be like God. We've got an opportunity to be like God when we give to our spouse. Verse 8, God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. So we give, God will make sure we are given back to, so that we can continue to give. So as each partner strives to give to the other, there's a closeness and an intimacy, in other words, a tight bond of love, is the inevitable result. So, brethren, deep intimacy in marriage takes an earnest and skillful blending of these ingredients of marital closeness. It takes earnest prayer to serve our spouse and imitate our elder brother, Jesus Christ. So let's dedicate time to our spouse by adding these ingredients together and blend them in to what can be a wonderful marriage and a wonderful life.